The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Empowerment Hour. We're video streaming live from our studio in New York City and broadcasting all over the world. In the last week, more than 50,000 new listeners have come on board. We are growing and expanding the fastest internet radio station in the world, plus all of our land-based stations, WBAI and KPFK in Los Angeles and all the others. We welcome all of you. Now, because people are coming on for the first time and they don't know my style or how I do things, let me just, for the hundreds of thousands of new listeners, let me just take just a second and let you know what we're going to do today. My guests will come in the second part of our program. In fact, our new policy is that our guests follow our health and nutrition. We always open with the latest cutting edge, always scientifically validated health and nutrition and healing. We don't look at newspapers or the media because they can be extremely biased and easily manipulated. A company can send them a press release saying, oh, you know, there's some new miracle treatment, and they don't do their homework, and they give it to you. Well, we don't use those. We go to the original peer-reviewed literature. We have over 560,000 studies that we have reviewed and shared with you. So when we're talking about something working, it's because science, official independent science, shows it does. Then from my own clinical experience, a PhD in human nutrition and public health science, professor at a university, and a research fellow in anti-aging medicine at the Institute of Applied Biology for 30 years, an investigative journalist, over 626 articles, 137 major cover stories or breaking stories over the years. Now, if you want to know what my background is and what I've done, please feel free to go to GaryKnoll.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and there you will see something my staff put together. In fact, I was out of town on the road as people's questions. So as an activist, testifying before different committees and panels at shows and leading demonstrations, as a journalist, as an author, as a nutritionist, having 28 separate programs on public television stations, all that's there. Six different bios, each one in a different field. Also, as far as the topics, I believe that the whole purpose of this hour is to empower people. And what that means is that I want to do my homework, so no matter what your background or your state of knowledge, once you finish listening to this hour, you will have gained new insights that you can, if you choose, apply them to make your life better. Sometimes when you hear troubling news, it's not all bad, because what if you didn't know it? Yesterday we played a clip. It was a very disturbing clip. You couldn't help but be moved by it, because the average American didn't know this existed. But it wasn't done by anyone in America. It was done by the BBC, and I'm going to play that again for you, for those of you who didn't hear it, just to remind you of what it means for us to be out of the loop. When you sit down to a meal and your family has a meal, that's good. When you never have to worry about being malnourished or your child going to school hungry, that's very good. But what about hunger? We think of Haiti and the Sudan. We think of the crisis in Darfur, or the Congo, where 5.5 million have been slaughtered in a genocide second only to the Second World War, since the Second World War, and yet very little is known about it. Now we know, because of the great work of Jeanine Roberts, the great 40-year veteran of British journalism, Blood Diamonds. She brought us the story of Blood Diamonds, but for her to get that story, she had to go to the Congo. She brought us the story of the Aboriginal children in Australia who were taken away from their parents and put into state-run foster care and no longer allowed to know their culture or language, something that happened in the United States through the Bureau of Indian Affairs back in the 18th, 19th century. She brought us that story. So when I bring you a story, it's not to sadden you, it's not to anger you, it's merely to inform you. But I trust that you are intelligent enough, independent thinking enough, that when brought something that is disturbing, you will say, now I know the truth, I must act upon it. Nuclear energy, why it's dangerous, why what we've been told are propaganda, not truths about its safety. Clean coal, an oxymoron that does not exist, but was a nice flip of the tongue. And hence people thought, well, that sounds good. I can support clean coal. You know, well, it doesn't exist. But the campaign does. So we do more investigative journalism on environmental issues with more environmental programs than any other program in the United States, more hard-hitting original investigative reporting than anyone else. But when I have a guest on, I do an extended introduction, longer than most. But then I stay quiet and allow an uninterrupted forum, like a classroom on the air, for my guests not to be interrupted, but to tell us what they have in the context with examples so we can relate to it. The other day I had Dylan Radigan on. I gave a 14-minute introduction based upon Emil Zola's I Accuse against Dreyfus, who was wrongly and falsely accused by a highly anti-Semitic Catholic Church and the powers within the right-wing, ultra-conservative fascist government of France at the time, and he was marooned to Devil's Island for treason he never committed. One journalist had the courage to stand up. So I wrote an essay, and in that essay, I reversed the notion of I accuse. Instead, I said, let us not blame. But it was a play on words. And I went through 45 different let us not blames. Let us not blame, I asked Dylan Radigan, let us not blame Barack Obama for telling us one thing and doing the opposite. Let us not blame a president who won a Nobel Peace Prize, then becoming the person that is engaged in endless militarization and wars and continued to allow us our imperial overreach. Let us not blame the banks for being bailed out but not helping a single homeowner restructure the value of their mortgage down to actual value of the property. Let us not blame the banks for charging exorbitant rates to student loans when those students are unemployed and cannot pay it back but now cannot declare bankruptcy and must live in a form of debt peonage similar to the 1800s. Let us not blame the epidemic of obesity in our children upon the advertisers and the products they sell. So after I went through all this, then I asked Dylan Radigan, are you going to be the next man who has the courage in the mainstream media, the official left, to stand up and call these things out and ask Americans to stop blaming and become responsible for those they put in office to make choices for them or for them to make those choices? That took 14 minutes. That's a long introduction. But listen to the context in which it was given and the lesson in the preamble, and then listen to his uninterrupted 47-minute answer. That's what I like about this program, a forum you do not find. This bantering chit-chat back and forth to me is just mindless candy cotton, pseudo-intellectualism, and disempowering us, not informing us. For those of you who have not heard us before, that gives you a little understanding of what this program is about. Now to our show today. My guest will be Robert Neuwirth. Robert is an investigative journalist. He has written articles for the New York Times, the Washington Post, The Nation, Fortune, and Wired. He has spent much of the past decade journeying through four continents to live in squatter communities, shanty towns, impoverished urban areas in the developing world to describe and earmark trends in city living amongst the poorest of the people and the vital forms of commerce and business they engage in. His book, The Shadow Cities, A Billion Squatters and a New Urban World, received a lot of acclaim, but his newest work is called Stealth of Nations, The Global Rise of the Informal Economy. So we're going to talk about a look at the System D economy. Now, you know that on this program, we like to lead trends, be ahead of them. Did you know about System D? How many of you have ever heard of System D? You will today because Robert's on it. How big is it? Few million dollars? How about $10 trillion? $10 trillion hidden economies off the nation's books and growing in the United States because Americans cannot trust either party. Both are globalists, both are neoliberal, both are fascistic in their pro-war positions, both supported the Patriot Act, and both don't give a damn if you get a job tomorrow as long as they keep theirs. You don't have health insurance, they got plenty. So he's going to tell us about how people are surviving and how you can survive. I think that's very important. Commentary coming at you in a few minutes, and we always do important commentaries. This one is going to give you the big picture from Dee's illustration, Susan Jennings' activist post. We're going to talk with my own comments included on digging deeper into who controls the world. Is this some conspiratorial rant? Not at all. Good scholarship, yes. Right in front of all of us, could have been discovered by anyone who chose to look. They chose not to look. We did. You're going to be informed. Let us begin. Now, from the environmental position, Harvey Wasserman from Common Dreams. Let me quote this. We may yet lose Tokyo, not to mention Alaska, and now Georgia too, as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission approves a construction operating license for two new reactors in Georgia. Alarming reports from Japan indicate the Fukushima catastrophe is far from over. Thousands of tons of intensely radioactive spent fuel are still in serious jeopardy. Radioactive trash and water are spewing into the environment. And nuclear engineer Arne Gunderson, who we've had on this program many times, reports that during the string of disasters following the March 11, 2011 earthquake and tsunami, Fukushima's first containment cap was actually lifted off its base, releasing dangerously radioactive gases and opening a gap for the hydrogen explosion that could happen. There are some two dozen of these same identical Mark I style containments in the United States. Newly released secret emails from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission also show its commissioners were totally clueless and in the dark about what actually happened right after Fukushima. So what did they do? Instead of taking an honest look, they simply covered it up along with the Japanese government. It's still spewing toxins. We've reported 13,000 deaths according to a peer-reviewed scientific article that was published in the United States due to this. And now, as I mentioned yesterday, 100 seals have washed up on shore. There's no other cause of death they can determine except all the signs of radiation poisoning. Large hair patches all over the body that are festering with ulcers and sores. Internal kidney and liver and heart damage not seen in normal or congenital defects. These were not old seals, these were younger seals. There was nothing in the water as a contaminant that could have caused this. The only exposure they would have had is radiation from Fukushima. So that's why we're keeping on top of that. Now, the latest in health and nutrition. There was an interesting analysis done by the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. What they did is they reviewed a lot of studies from around the world, independent studies. And this was done through Jetong University School of Medicine in Shanghai, and they looked at 8,436 cases of lung cancer. And what they found was this, and this is what's important. Increasing your soy intake lowered your lung cancer risk by 23%. So that's a big drop by just increasing the soy. And why? Because soy has isoflavones. And that is the active ingredient that helps you. Separately, vitamin D was shown to be inversely related to a risk of cancer. This is published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention. And here's what it says. When you have better levels of vitamin D circulating in your blood, you're at lower risk for pancreatic cancer. And this was based upon 5 large prospective studies. So I suggest between 2 to 5,000 international units of vitamin D a day, or a half hour of good sunlight a day. And that'll create about 15 to 20,000 units of vitamin D in your skin. Small amounts of omega-3 fatty acids reduce arrhythmia-related events and fatal heart attack risk in diabetic patients. Now, why should we be concerned? Because you have about 25 to 30 million diabetics. You have up to 50 million pre-diabetics, or people susceptible to insulin resistance, mainly people who are overweight. So you're talking about 75 to 80 million people who need to know this. So if you take 2,000 units of vitamin the omega-3 fatty acids in your diet each day. And you can get them both from vegan sources, as I do, like flaxseed oil and omega-3 fatty acids. Come also from walnut oil, good or fish oil. And that can lower your risk of arrhythmia and fatal heart attacks. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Diabetes Care. And finally, high antioxidant diet associated with fewer strokes. This is from Stroke, the peer-reviewed journal. And here's what it says. I'll quote, researchers from Sweden report that consuming a diet that is rich in antioxidants is associated with lower risk of stroke in women. They evaluated 31,035 women with no history of heart disease, 5,680 with a history of heart disease, and they find that those that had the highest ORAC, or antioxidant capacity, had the lowest risk, and it was substantially lower, 46% reduced risk of hemorrhagic stroke. So, and this is one of probably 200 studies showing that by increasing the dietary intake of fruits and vegetables and fresh juices and antioxidants like vitamin C, vitamin E, you can help prevent a stroke. And remember, the greens thin your blood. Vitamin C thins your blood, the omega-3 fatty acids thin your blood, and vitamin E thins your blood. All good for you. And if we can prevent someone from dying and having a stroke, we have an obligation to do so. And if not in ourselves, how about our parents? Even those who are a little hard-headed at times and don't want to hear what we have to say, keep talking about it. Because otherwise, every 20 seconds in America, someone will have either a stroke or a heart attack. And about every 35 seconds, they die. So you could be preventing a death by getting them to increase their antioxidants. I'm Gary Knoll. Now for our commentary, then a break, then back with my guest. And I'm going to ask you to be able to call in and share your points of view in our talkback segment on essential issues. This has to do with what I've been discussing. It is my belief that over a 30-year period, slowly, certain rights that we take for granted have been infringed upon or out and out suspended, like habeas corpus. Do you remember when we found out by accident through a whistleblower that the major telecom companies had been allowing the government agencies to eavesdrop on all of our phone calls, all of our emails? Well, that offended us. And also, it was illegal. So what did they do? They passed a law that made it no longer illegal, the FISA bill. And who was the largest single campaign contributor to the Democratic Convention and paid for all the high-quality technology and screens and the largest telecommunications company that would have been at the center of that controversy? It was a big, wet kiss back to the Democrats for them supporting, don't make what we did illegal. So they gave money, and it was no longer illegal. But step by step, now if you demonstrate, the FBI, under Freedom of Information Act, was found that anyone engaged in animal rights is now on a watch list. In fact, they have been looking at the computers, cell phones, and now with the drones in the United States, and Congress just passed yesterday a law allowing 30,000 drones in the United States, 30,000, to monitor us with all kinds of new technology, including eye scanning, face recognition. And we don't know about it unless someone lets it out. And it's almost too hard to imagine this. Why? So if you protest anything that challenges official corporate control or government policies, you're now an enemy? What about our freedom of speech? What about our rights to protest peacefully? Well, you can kiss those goodbye. It's happening. 80% of the world's wealth appears to be earned by a core 1,318 corporations. That's all. I thought it was around 1,700, but it's actually 1,318 corporations, which in turn are being controlled by only 147 companies. 75% of these companies are financial institutions, and the top companies on the list are the Federal Reserve Banks. Now you know why I want to see the Federal Reserve Bank closed and only the Treasury allowed to print and issue currency, because then we have control over it. The Federal Reserve is not federal. It is private, and there's no capacity to audit it. And that it was stated as a matter of record by the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, who said that, quote, the Federal Reserve is an independent agency. There is no other agency of government who can outrule or overrule our actions, end quote. Well, that's some arrogance, isn't it? But he was correct. The Federal Reserve created $26 to $29 trillion worth of bailouts exclusively in 22,000 transactions for their own companies between 2007 and 2010, or those in that group I mentioned. This was revealed in their own audit statements and confirmed by the U.S. Congressman and prominent financial analyst. And this only happened because Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, included this as a part of the oversight. We wouldn't have known this otherwise. So while the banks that were foreclosing on your home, the banks that were causing you recourse rates on your credit cards, were getting unlimited amounts of money for toxic assets. And toxic means, let's say that your mortgage was $200,000. But now the market makes it worth $100,000. And so they would give your mortgage as collateral at $200,000. No one was auditing their statements. Our founding fathers were adamantly opposed to a centrally private-controlled bank. Different companies having the same board members, that's one way they work. This also includes members of the same family who may be on different boards. And the ongoing movement between government leaders into private sector executive and board positions or lobbying positions for companies they formerly regulated or vice versa, like Timothy Geithner, former New York Federal Reserve Bank president, becomes Obama's administration's Secretary of the Treasury, or Robert Rubin, who was formerly chairman of the board of Goldman Sachs, then goes over and becomes Treasury Secretary, then goes back to Citigroup with a $115 million payout package. Stocks or bonds held in other companies like Goldman, considering keeping the majority of Facebook shares in initial public stock offering. The division of competing brand names owned by the same company. Now look at Procter & Gamble. So you may think you're getting a better deal, but it's all going to the same company. Funding through private foundations for various associations like the American Medical Association since 1910 and the National Education Association are heavily funded by both the Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundations. Why? The majority of radio, television, large internet companies has become concentrated in the hands of just a few companies. 50 independent companies once comprised the media. How long ago was that? 1983. Today, Time Warner, CNN, TBC, TNT, AOL, Fortune, People, News Corp, Fox, New York Post, Wall Street Journal, Market Watch, Walt Disney, ABC, ESPN, Miramax, Pixar, Bertelsmann, most European Union stations, Random House, National Geographic magazines, Viacom, CBS, Simon & Schuster, Comedy Central, GE, NBC, Telemundo, MSNBC, just a handful of people and companies control all that media. Such consolidation creates the ability to easily manipulate the masses via television, radio, and print media. This includes global news, political information, science, health, and social values, which we have all seen go down the toilet. The desensitization of dead bodies and increasing violence, glorification of antisocial behavior. The ones doing the most lying, cheating, stealing are always the winners. Have you watched what kind of ethic and morality we see in any of these reality television shows? Would you want any of these people in your family? Would you actively seek a friend from the housewives of any of these places? I don't think so. The invasive surveillance systems to accumulate the information and to acclimate the public to a complete loss of privacy. So one day, you don't even mind that you don't have any privacy. The lack of unbiased actual reporting on critical events. As a result, the National Defense Authorization Act, SOPA, PIPA legislation have all had a positive slant on them in mainstream media. The NDAA wipes out the Fourth Amendment right to due process, and the latter two proposed laws remove our free access to websites, giving the government the right to take down Internet sites at will. Thus, their interests seem to be solely in maximizing their profits, no matter what the detrimental effects on the environment, the social and health of all of us, all the while maintaining control of the global population in its media. These few controlling global companies have financial interests in non-renewable energy industry and pharmaceutical companies. For example, Bing that the latest information on the British Petroleum and Gulf of Mexico oil spill and the Japanese Fukushima nuclear meltdowns reveal initial disinformation of the actual extent of these catastrophic events. In Texas, the ads run by the natural gas hydrofracking companies purported to, quote, protect the water supply are a good example of test results being ignored that showed it was polluting it, especially when tap water and stock tanks and groundwater continue to show contamination of toxic cancer-causing chemicals used in the fracking process. So where is the FCC's truth in advertising policy being enforced? Many of the so-called news stories about new drugs or new types of medical testing or equipment are actually produced by the companies who are selling us these drugs, tests, and equipment, and they are influencing the health of the profession itself. Politics has become blatantly corrupted and immoral. So as long as it suits a super PAC, which is a political action committee agenda, there are zero limits as to the validity of their ads for their candidates. The Supreme Court January 21, 2010 decision on the Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission gave corporations legal entities with no human attributes the same constitutional free speech rights as humans. 30 years ago, this court ruled that spending money is a part of free speech. This ruling overturned the part of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform that prohibited corporate and union-funded campaign advertising within 90 days of an election. Montana Supreme Court restored their state's 100-year-old ban on direct corporate spending on January 12th of this year. This will force a revisit of this matter back to the Supreme Court. So there we are. That's just to let you know how it's going down. Your thoughts, 888-874-4888. 888-874-48. Before we go to our break, just a replay of a short little 3-minute piece that no American media has touched, no one has played, because I believe Americans are sensitive enough that if they heard this, it would impact them.
They get a double bag, they get a bottle of water.
But back at Whitney School, the teachers see a different reality. Free school meals only get the children here through the week. So on Fridays, they pack them food for the weekend too.
We need to make about 150 bags. These are little beefaroni type cups. They're pop top because a lot of the kids don't have cooking facilities, so they can just pop top this open and eat it cold if they need to.
The fact is that now 20 million Americans, almost half the poor, earn less than $11,000 or £7,000 a year for a family of four. The numbers living in deep poverty have exploded under President Obama.
I work in the cafeteria for lunch duty, and a lot of times I would see children putting ketchup packets in their pockets, lots of them, to take home. For what they do is they add a little water to them and make ketchup soup, and just noticing that the kids were very hungry all the time.
The teachers told us poor children here ate very badly at home, but we assumed they had enough food. They got together a group of pupils whose families they know are struggling.
We don't have any dinner at home.
How often does that happen?
Well, it's already happened 5 times.
How has that felt?
Well, it felt kind of weird because it felt like I was kind of getting dizzy one time.
Have you ever not been able to have dinner at home?
Yeah. I went to bed hungry because my parents didn't make anything, and we had nothing to eat. So I just went to bed and waited until I went to school to eat, and I was very, very hungry.
How did that feel?
Well, when I went to bed, I tried to ignore it, but my tummy kept on growling and growling, and it made me so mad.
Stephen is troubled by a host of worries most 8-year-olds don't have. His mother is pregnant.
We don't have enough money to get the food for the baby. I feel real sad for it. So that's why my mom thinks we're going to give it to adoption. But I'm not sure if it costs money. And the good thing about it, my mom gets to choose who it is.
Leslie is six. She was more withdrawn than the others.
That's what that was. My mom eats rats.
Eating rats? Is that something that you eat a lot, or it just happened once?
Once.
It just happened once? Was that because she ran out of food? Yeah. How did that make you feel?
Yeah.
Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash. I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
Imagine for a moment that somewhere in the middle of Texas, there was a large foreign military base. Say Chinese or Russian. Imagine that thousands of armed foreign troops were constantly patrolling American streets in military vehicles. Imagine they were here under the auspices of keeping us safe, or promoting democracy, or protecting their strategic interests. Imagine that they operated outside of U.S. law and that the Constitution did not apply to them. Imagine that every now and then they made mistakes or acted on bad information and accidentally killed or terrorized innocent Americans, including women and children, most of the time with little or no repercussions or consequences. Imagine that they set up checkpoints on our soil and routinely searched and ransacked entire neighborhoods of homes. Imagine if Americans were fearful of these foreign troops and overwhelmingly thought America would be better off without their presence. Imagine if some Americans were so angry about them being in Texas that they actually joined together to fight them off in defense of our soil and sovereignty because leadership in government refused or were unable to do so. Imagine that those Americans were labeled terrorists or insurgents for their defensive actions and routinely killed or captured or tortured by the foreign troops on our land. Imagine that the occupiers' attitude was that if they just killed enough Americans, the resistance would stop. But instead, for every American killed, 10 more would take up arms against them, resulting in perpetual bloodshed. Imagine if most of the citizens of the foreign land also wanted these troops to return home. Imagine if they elected a leader who promised to bring them home and put an end to this horror. Imagine if that leader changed his mind once he took office. The reality is that our military presence on foreign soil is as offensive to the people that live there as armed Chinese troops would be if they were stationed in Texas. Shutting down military bases
and seeking to deal with other nations with threats and violence is not isolationism. It is the opposite. Opening ourselves up to friendship, honest trade, and diplomacy is the foreign policy of peace and prosperity. It is the only foreign policy that will not bankrupt us in the short order, as our current actions most definitely will. I share the disappointment of the American people in the foreign policy rhetoric coming from the administration. The sad thing is, our foreign policy will change eventually, as Rome's did, when all budgetary and monetary tricks to fund it are exhausted.
Wouldn't it be nice if we had politicians of both parties who realized that what we do to others, we should also ask, what if they did to us? Is any baby, any child in the world freezing to death in Afghanistan, dying 500,000 because of Clinton's original embargo of food and other utilities, not intentionally and illegally blowing up their water supplies, which had nothing to do with affecting Saddam Hussein, but his people. Imagine if anyone did what we do to others to us. How then would we scream with moral outrage and indignation of this injustice? And yet we do this to them in the name of peace and freedom and democracy. Let us think on our actions before we pursue them. There is nothing discussing this except for Ron Paul. And no matter what you may think of Ron Paul, why don't they debate him? Why don't they debate all people who believe that we shouldn't be in imperial overreach and close down these bases and cut back our military defense funding? What if we had people who were pro-peace and not pro-war? I'm Gary Nall. Your thoughts. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Joining me in studio now, as promised, is Robert Neuwirth. Robert, nice to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here, Gary.
All right, let's begin. And we're filming in studio. A little shaky camera because we have a cinematographer walking around the room. For our listeners unfamiliar with the term System D, as it pertains to an economy that is now prevalent throughout the world, and particularly in developing nations, I'd like you to begin by defining it and providing us with a sense of how far-reaching and vital this underground economy is for millions of people who have no other way of earning a living, including right here in the United States. Now, I'm not referring to prostitution or drug use. I'm not referring to that. I'm just referring to normal ways that people try to survive, and we're talking about $10 trillion, an enormous amount of money each year.
Absolutely.
The forum is yours. Take your time,
okay.
As I said.
Well,
I want you to tell us the story.
The phrase that's normally used by academics is the informal or underground economy. And I've pirated System D from the former French colonies in Caribbean and Africa. And the French have a word called débrouillardise, which sort of means self-reliance or ingenuity. And to call someone a débrouillard is to call them, incredibly ingenious in how they do things. And in the former colonial reality, they've sculpted that term to the economics of the nation, and they've referred to something called l'économie de la débrouillardise, or they shorten it to système D, which means the DIY economy, the do-it-yourself economy, the ingenuity economy. And it struck me that that's a much better phrase than something like informal or underground, because it connotes two things. First of all, that there's a positive attribute of ingeniousness and self-reliance. And secondly, that it's a system. It's an alternate system that people use. The economic system that dominates in the developed part of the world is essentially broken. It's kind of a closed shop. The problems have been identified for hundreds of years and were last stated most directly by Keynes back in 1936 when he wrote his great book. And he mentioned them. He said unemployment and inequality are the two big problems that we face. And what System D does is address both of them. System D is the way that people get jobs and earn money, and System D allows for a more egalitarian market and economy. So basically what we're talking about is businesses that are started, formed, and work for their entire life cycle out of the view of government. These are businesses that don't necessarily get licensed, don't necessarily get registered, don't necessarily pay taxes, but nonetheless are dealing in legal products and legal services just in this quasi-legal way. So as you mentioned, Gary, we're not talking about drug dealers, we're not talking about human trafficking, we're not talking about human slavery or prostitution. We're talking about normal buying and selling, just like if you walk downstairs and go into Duane Reade here in New York. Just being done without the participation of government. And this is basically how everyone gets their start in business in the world, and indeed, once upon a time, was how people got their start in business in the United States. So just taking an example, Frederick Stanley, who went on to found Stanley Tools, originally sold tools from a backpack and then packs on the side of a mule. He didn't have a business license. He wasn't incorporated. He just was a peddler. Same thing with Dick Sears, who went on to found Sears Roebuck. Same thing with the street peddler whose empire became Van Heusen shirts. So this is not a new phenomenon, but it's something that has always existed as the incubator economy in the world. In the developing world, it's massive, and it's also a fact of life all over the world. We just pretend that it's criminal and horrible. When you run the numbers, we're talking, as you mentioned, about $10 trillion a year of economic activity that's generated this way. And to put it in some perspective, that means that if all these unlicensed merchants were allied in a single nation state, it would be the second largest economy on Earth. It would be a superpower. It would be number two to the United States. Which means that this is a massive territory. It involves half the workers of the world, and the statistics are that that will rise to two-thirds of the workers of the world by the end of this decade. And it's how people live, it's how people make money, it's how people engage in trade. In most of the world, it's totally open. You can find it in every street market, in every city of the world, at every border crossing of every city in the world, where people smuggle things across the border very normally. And it's known by governments, and in many cases they allow it to happen. But they've been cracking down on it now with this rhetoric of we want to collect taxes because these people are evil and they're not paying their fair share in taxes. It turns out when you talk with the merchants in the street economies of the world, they're actually paying fees to the government that total more than they would be paying in licenses and taxes. It's just an underground fee that government officials pocket for the right to do business and not be disturbed by people. So the corruption in government means the government is actually getting more from these people than they would be in taxes. It's just the government officials aren't turning it over to the government, not the fault of the merchants. What this does is allow half the workers of the world to survive. And so it's an amazing economic sphere, and it exists everywhere, and even in the United States. I mean, one of the interesting things I found out is in terms of system de-employment, the United States is one of the smallest informal economies in the world, about between 8 and 9% of gross domestic product here in the United States. But given the size of our economy, that's more than $1 trillion worth of value, and that makes us the largest informal economy in the world right here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that overview. It was about 15 or so years ago in Detroit, they were going through a really bad recession.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asked by some of my listeners, would I come out there? So I did. And all I heard was what was negative. And so with a smaller group that had... in fact, one of the people who had invited me, we went back to their home, and I said, tell me all the things you can do. What's that going to do? We got to get back to work. We can't pay our mortgage. We can't feed ourselves. I said, that's not what I ask you. I know the problem, but I'm going to help you now with the solution. Tell me what you like to do and you're good at. And so she loved to bake. She was good at that. And her husband, when we went through about 30 things he liked to do, one of them really popped up. He had come from a family, like many of us did, baby boomers, where he was self-sufficient. He could fix things. I said, all right, why don't we try this as an experiment? Why don't you take a look at all the things that people eat in the factory where you did work until you were laid off, and then make them a lunch. But it'll be homemade, and it'll be healthy, and then go up there each morning with a sign saying, help support those of us who are, you know, unemployed by buying your lunch from us, and make it affordable. So therefore, they can't say, well, I'm paying you too much. It's the same thing they'd pay if they went out and bought stuff themselves. But now they're helping another colleague. And she didn't know if it worked so well that she couldn't handle all the people, because then it became solidarity. We're going to buy our lunch, you know, and then we're going to... And then I said, all right, and how about kids' brown bagging lunches? So she had a whole thriving business, and others took up that. Then her husband began to put out a resume of, do you have leaky windows or broken concrete, any bad pipes, any termite, anything at all in your house? Another one, a car. And so within about 6 months, all these people were engaged in doing something completely legitimate that people historically had done, but now got others to do for them. But they were all making more money through this, what you might call your underground economy. And none of them were licensed. They just did it and to survive because the government wasn't helping them. You know, no one else was helping them. So they helped themselves. Good for them.
Exactly.
Down in Florida now, I know that there are street after street after street that are taking in renters and charging them half the rent that they would pay if they rented a place. But they also have to do something around there. In other words, like cut the grass or something. Mm-hmm. Now, they're not licensed for that. And they're very strict down in Florida. They're very anal, and the bureaucrats are everywhere. I mean, if you plant a tree that you're not supposed to, they want to come out there and charge you $400 for it. But everywhere you go, in fact, one day I was filming for this new documentary on poverty, and it was a Saturday. As I'm driving up this one road in this one town in eastern Florida, near Orlando, I see there's a whole lot of people, and I'm thinking, why does there six cars in that little driveway? It's a small, this is a middle-class community, right? Mm-hmm. And on a football day, you could understand that. But this was a Saturday morning, so and there's so many houses. So I just pulled over, got out of my car, walked down, and the first guy I met, you know, he comes and he says, what do you want? I said, I'm here to try to understand what it means to be the new poor in America. He said, well, you got that right. And I said, would you be willing to tell me your story? He said, what for? I said, I want to take this message and show other Americans what they're not aware of, especially those in New York and Los Angeles, who, because they're fortunate enough, and I don't begrudge anyone who's fortunate enough not to be suffering, good for them. But for the 245 million Americans, two-thirds of the population that are suffering, and it's not going to get better, not in this lifetime, it can only be changed if people know about it. Okay. So then we went in and we sat down. And then suddenly everybody came out of the bedrooms. They were all hiding. They thought it was some government inspector.
Sure.
And what they were doing, that whole block, they were taking a Saturday and Sunday to fix up their basements, attics, and garages into living space with bunk beds and places for their in-laws or family that couldn't afford or lost their homes and coming back there, rather than just couch surfing and sleeping on a couch.
Mm-hmm.
So at least they had some privacy away from the rest of the family. And they said that we can't do this during the week because the inspectors go up and down the streets looking for illegal zoning residency, and then they'll come in, and then they'll fine you, and we can't afford that. And one of the people said, I ever saw you on television, on PBS? I said, yes. Oh, you know, and then suddenly it's, and now, then they introduced me. So from one family, I was able to interview everyone, and then I filmed them, and you'll see this in my new film, how Americans are surviving. Now, some are surviving by bringing in renters. Some are surviving by, you know, just their in-laws. But the state and the county and the city doesn't want any of this to happen. If you go to get a permit, they won't give it to you. Well, no, our zoning says you have a 1,500 square, you only have three bedrooms, you can't, and you don't, and the septic system, and so they don't think about what it's like to be a homeless person. They don't care. The indifference of some of these bureaucrats, and then you wonder why some people are protesting the inefficient bureaucracies, the insensitive bureaucrats, with gee whiz, because we should be incensed by insensitivity to our suffering. All right? So that taken into account, please continue. And also, remember the stories in the Great Depression where one of the largest co-ops in America for almost 10 years was people who had talent. They would fix up broken radios and lamps and then resell them to people who didn't have much money but still sure. needed things. And this was a whole separate economy. There were over 250,000 people engaged in that co-op, a workers repair handyman co-op. You never hear about that.
Right. I mean, these are inspiring things, and most of my reporting over the last, I'd say, 4 years was done in the developing world, and that's where I focused much of my research. But you find the same kind of cooperative initiatives in the developing world. I'll just give you some examples. Lagos, Nigeria is a massive African megacity, population somewhere between 9 million and 17 million, depending on where you draw the lines and who's counting. But it's based on a crumbling colonial infrastructure of a city built for 250,000 people. So there's no water system at all in the city. And there's an electrical grid, but Nigeria, in a deal with some of its neighboring countries, sells all of its electricity to its neighbors. And so there's very little electricity that ever goes out over the grid. So these are people without water and without electricity. So what has happened is that in this ingenious way, System D has responded to the lack of government services by figuring out how to provide them. So first, the way you get water in a situation like in Lagos is you dig a very deep well that locals call a borehole. And it's very expensive to do. So only the rich people can afford to dig wells. But people, entrepreneurs, have figured out that they can share this cost and keep water cheap enough. So what they do is they buy machinery from China, they dig a deep well, and they produce baggies full of water, which they sell on the street for 5 or 10 naira, which is about 4 cents or a nickel, maybe 6 cents. And that's the massive way that most people in Lagos get water, baggies of water that are sold on the street. Now, there was a problem that the government recognized with the potential for bacteria being in the water or the water not being safe to drink. And so they created a middle ground bureaucracy where they said, fine, we will inspect your water and make sure it's safe to drink, and we'll give you a number, an approval number. And so every bag of water produced by these informal companies is now inspected and determined to be safe to drink so that the Nigerians can have safe drinking water. And same thing with the electrical system. People brought in generators. And every place in Lagos, I'm not making an argument for inefficient diesel generators by any means because they're very polluting. But in the absence of a decent electrical system, this is what people did.
Or any electrical system.
Yes, correct. So there are generators for every price point. You can get a tiny motor that's enough to power a feeble light bulb. You can get a massive locomotive-sized generator, which is used to power a luxury hotel. They're all brought into the country, and they are the electrical system. They call them backup generators, but in reality, they're the primary electrical system. Because when I was in Lagos, I can tell you one day the power came on for exactly 20 seconds. We all ran to plug in our mobile phones and charge them up based on municipal power, and then the power went off after 20 seconds, and it was off for another 24 hours. So people need the generators to be in the 21st century and to have electrical power. And this is brought in by merchants who have traveled to China, bought generators, shipped them back to Lagos in containers. They've fudge their manifests to avoid customs duties because it's extremely expensive at the Lagos port to bring things through. Sometimes they bring them through from a neighboring port that's called a free port, and then they smuggle them across the border from the Republic of Benin into Nigeria. But they do this because people need electrical power. It's the demand that's spawning the ingenious creation of the supply. And every street market in Lagos, and these are massive street markets, has created a cooperative structure, an elected leadership of the market, a market court where buyers and sellers can adjudicate. If you feel you were ripped off by a merchant at that market, you can take that dispute to the market court. And they come up with solutions or force the merchant to give you a new product or whatever it might be. There are cooperative security forces as the merchants band together to make sure that people aren't ripping off buyers in their market, because that'll keep people away. So there are many cooperative structures that are being created in the developing world that are providing the kinds of services that, yes, a good and quality and representative and transparent government should be providing, but is not providing. And so the people are providing it for themselves. It's tremendously inspiring.
Is it true that half of workers in the world are connected with the System D?
Yeah, it's not my statistic. This comes from a major think tank sponsored by the 30 largest capitalist countries in the world called the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
Is it also true that the U.S., the underground market here is 8.3% of the gross domestic product? But it's still over $1 trillion a year?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. That's probably a conservative estimate, actually.
Well, I think people are going to go into that market because we're now realizing how few authentic solutions exist where they tell us that the unemployment rate is 8.3%. We know it's 20% because they're not including all the people to stop. And
right.
And also, we
right. even last night, with statistics.
Yeah,
right.
Even last night on Keith Urban, who should know better, when he keeps pounding on this idea of how much better the economy is, how many jobs. And if you look, it's all a myth. Last year, there was 1.9 million jobs lost. This year, it was 1.7 million. So the difference became 272,000. Oh, those weren't jobs created. That was just less jobs lost, adjusted seasonally.
Right.
So how do you make less of a bad thing become a positive thing? Well, that's what happens in official politics and official ideologies. But the average American's not fooled by any of this. And as you heard from that little girl, when a little girl who has no responsibility for causing any of our problems has to eat rats in order to survive, and a kid goes to bed and tries not to think about his empty belly, then it shows you we have to rethink all that we're doing on all levels.
Yeah. Can I just add, Gary, that the priorities are messed up. And you were mentioning your friends in Detroit, the woman who was able to bake and make school lunches and stuff like that. And here we're here in New York City, broadcasting from New York City. And you cannot get government approval to create food that you're going to sell in your home kitchen. It's just not allowed in New York. And so no one could be legal doing that. Although the government has a tendency to sort of turn the other way and allow sort of more wealthy businesses to do it, people making lobster rolls or fancy pastries that are sold in fancy coffee bars. But if the lady on my corner who sells tamales does it, she risks big, big, big fines.
Yeah, this is all wrong. Let's hope at some point we actually get some progressive people in positions to change all this. Robert, thank you very much for coming on.
It's a pleasure, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Robert Neuwirth, N-E-U-W-I-R-T-H, my guest. The book is called Stealth of Nations. I'm Gary Knoll. If you miss anything from a program, go to our website and download it again. It's non-commercial and free for you. Have a nice day, everyone.
We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. I'm going to Jackson, I'm gonna mess around. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson, look out Jackson Town.
We'll go.
I'm gonna snowball Jackson.
See if I can.
When I breeze into that city, people gonna stoop and bow. All them women gonna make me teach them what they don't know how. I'm going to Jackson. You turn loose of my coat. 'Cause I'm going to Jackson.